This is another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk, and there's more at allbook-books.com and my Substack page. This week I want to loosely, but specifically, draw attention to a topic that I was reminded of. And so it's often overlooked, I think. That's why I want to accentuate it. Most of the world problems are looked at through the lens of the capitalism and the greed and the wars and the attacks on Mother Earth and all that, which is totally valid, which is a totally valid way to address the problems. But I also think that perhaps obvious to some, but also gets overlooked, is the squelching of the people and the populist movements specifically. And this has shown up anytime their so-called communist or socialist movements say, I think that was part of the reason for the Vietnam War, was to stop the communists. And much of the U.S. Empire's anti-Latin America is due to their being socialist or democratic socialist governments. And historically, one could consider the indigenous peoples as, I don't want to inaccurately label, but the community lifestyle or communal lifestyle is just the antithesis of the capitalist, imperialist individuality and greed. So the enemy in general becomes the people move, the populist movement, or the people. And whenever they start to amass power, or have to start a sway, then that becomes on the radar of the powers that do too much. So the Chris Hedges report is a weekly video interview, and this week he has on Vincent Bevins, who has a book, If We Burn: The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. I found it quite interesting, so that's why I'll read the blurb for the show. There was a decade of popular uprisings from 2010 until the global pandemic in 2020. These uprisings shook the foundations of the global order. They denounced corporate domination, austerity cuts, and demanded economic justice and civil rights. The Occupy Wall Street and the Black Lives Matter mass demonstrations following the execution of George Floyd in 2020 are cases. There were also popular eruptions in Greece, Spain, Tunisia, Egypt, Bahrain, Yemen, Syria, Libya, Turkey, Brazil, Ukraine, Hong Kong, Chile, and during South Korea's Candlelight Revolution. Discredited politicians were driven from office in Greece, Spain, Ukraine, South Korea, Egypt, Chile, and Tunisia. Reform, or at least the promise of it, dominated public discourse. It seemed to herald a new era. Then, the backlash. The aspirations of the popular movements were crushed. State control and social inequality expanded. There was no significant change. In most cases, things got worse. The far right emerged triumphant. What happened? How did a decade of mass protests that seemed to herald democratic openness, an end to state repression, a weakening of the domination of global corporations and financial institutions, and an era of freedom sputter to an ignominious failure? What went wrong? How did the hated bankers and politicians maintain or regain control? What are the effective tools to rid ourselves of corporate domination? So this is what he discusses in the interview, more from the political movement side of it. But what it made me think of is what came along in 2021. I think it was 2021. The COVID plandemic. So I'm not going to get into trying to prove anything, but I just think that's an interesting connection there, that because I have felt there's a lot of talk about the pandemic. There was obviously an immense transfer of wealth to the elites, while tons of people around the world, small businesses in America and businesses around the world, it reshuffled the whole economic system. Prices have gone up. Now food is up like 30% because of that, basically. And also the sanctions on Russia and other reasons, but the supply chains and all that. But so I'm not going to say that was the purpose of all that. But there's a to me, there's a significant connection there that's deserving of noting. Thus this podcast. I would also add to Hedges' introduction that I don't think, and the book, I don't think it's just far right, because you have the, you know, the so-called left wing currently now with the U.S. is just ramped up the billions for war, whether it's Ukraine or now the genocide in Gaza. That's the U.S. imperialist recipe. So that's left. That's left, so-called left wing, which has become more right than some of the right nowadays. But anyway, that's a whole other sidetrack. That's a sidetrack, tridetrack to the gist of it. And over my years of studying stuff, some years ago, I've mentioned this book numerous times, Mark Curtis, Secret Affairs, Britain's Collusion with Radical Islam. That's from 2010, but one of the things that stood out about that book, after reading similar things many times, was the exact thing that I'm talking about is one of the main agendas is the squelching of what I'll just simplify as populist movements. So here he is in one section after a quote from somebody. This was a neat summary of Britain's preference for repressive regimes backed by the Islamic right rather than more popular or democratic movements. A permanent feature of British policy in the region, past and present, that helps explain the regular resort to connivance with Islamist forces. So obviously that's a whole loaded sidetrack there. The title says it, Britain's Collusion with Radical Islam. Not that Radical Islam was the enemy as it was portrayed in the news, but quite the opposite. And that Britain's preference for repressive regimes backed by the Islamic right rather than more popular or democratic movements. And towards the end of the book, these words can be expressed to be received gratefully by Gulf leaders keen to stave off the threat of democracy. So there's another phrase, to stave off the threat of democracy. So that's how they truly feel about so-called democracy. That's how they truly feel about genuine democracy. And then here's another towards the end of the book. Saudi forces entered Bahrain in a convoy of British-made armored personnel carriers known as Tacticus, which were manufactured by the British company BAE Systems. Saudi Arabia's National Guard, trained by Britain since 1964 to ensure the defense of the House of Saud, was part of the Saudi force and British training in internal security over many years, and British training in internal security over many years would no doubt have helped develop tactics to suppress the popular uprising in Bahrain. Other British-supplied equipment to the Bahrainis included tear gas and crowd control ammunition, equipment for the use of aircraft cannons, assault rifles, shotguns, sniper rifles, and submachine guns, all of which had been supplied in 2010. And this is quite similar to the crackdown at Standing Rock, which, again, is a could be called a people or populist movement. In that case, you have to include the defense of the land and the water, not just label it a populist movement, because from the native perspective, that's all in there together. And then again, towards the end of the book, actually the last paragraph of the book, British influence in the Middle East in recent decades should not be exaggerated, but there is no doubt that it has contributed to the rise of radical Islam and the undermining of secular, more liberal forces, which the British public is told by their governments and media are Britain's allies around the world. The policy has promoted violence and wars, the overthrow of often popular governments, the bolstering of the most reactionary domestic forces, as well as tensions between states and sectarian divisions within them. Government policies are widely believed to be pursued in the national interest, but this in the national interest is in single quotes, but this is a myth. Britain's foreign policy making system is far removed from promoting the public interest. Rather, Whitehall's secret affairs with radical Islam have increased the terrorist threat to Britain and the world. A distinctly immoral aspect of foreign policy has made Britain, the Middle East, and much of the rest of the world more insecure. Now, this can be said in the U.S. as well. The sort of the son or daughter, not to offend any gender people, of the, that was a little bit of flippant sarcasm there, because I respect all gender people, but I'm just trying to be politically correct with the U.S. Empire as the son or daughter of the British Empire. But also, many people who, or some people that I've spoken to recently who seem to, or that I've read about, who defend Israel in their genocidal attacks, will point to anti-Semitism. So, yeah, the anti-Semitism is an issue and a side issue, but bombing and imprisoning people and putting them in an outdoor concentration camp for decades does not help prevent anti-Semitism. So, in all of these situations, one has to look at, and in looking at the news and the way the stories are presented and the backlash of, you know, quote, terrorism and things like that, one has to look at the both sides of the story first before making one's assessment. So that raises the question if these big movements, like in the Hedges interview, Bevins mentions that many of the media tends to control the storyline and the narrative of whenever there's a popular movement in the streets, like Occupy was squelched not by right wing, that at the time was, you know, quote, left center, maybe Mayor Bloomberg at the time, who's I wouldn't consider far right, but his efforts, along with the FBI coordinated across the country, was to shut down Occupy. Now, I wasn't totally a fan of Occupy because of the native perspective. I think the land is already occupied, so it was more of an un-Occupy movement first. But the point is that was another popular movement that got squelched. So if these movements are prevalent and they're out there and they're all blasted over the social media, which is often being surveillanced, then how does these huge popular movements avoid being co-opted? Like Black Lives Matter, from what I've read, was basically co-opted. Climate, all these things that get co-opted when they get into the public media venues. So that's the topical Zen koan of the day. My answer, which has been my answer for a long time, is the small groups and the small, you know, small and local communities, small to foster and nurture local small groups, communities, interactions, whether it's official or just a bunch of friends that you see in different places or near you and you talk and this and that. There's many angles to it, and that's a whole nother story, a whole nother topic to discuss there. This is not to say I don't say that huge movements can't stop things. They can't stop things. For example, in Europe, the farmers, the farmers are like kick ass, man. They put tractors in the roadways and stop, you know, they stop the country from functioning. And last I heard, they get some of what they want with the changes. So that's sorely lacking in the U.S. But there is the risk of a violent crackdown. But there are ways to for a mass movement to make big change. So I think it's not just the small groups. I think that's in a way the long-term under the radar way, but there is room. I won't say that's the answer, because that's one of the answers, as the also the mass movements can do things too. So it's a conundrum to ponder. So thanks for listening, and be well.